Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with Vanity Fair's digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hello, Katie.
And Vanity Fair senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
So we may as well get this out of the way. We are recording on Election Day, so we don't know how the election has turned out, and you do as you listen to this. So be kind to us. So our nerves are way more frazzled than yours are probably as you listen to this. But it's a good thing that there is an entire industry devoted to escapist entertainment to take our mind off of the election, and that would be Hollywood. We're going to dive into both TV and film today, talking about Netflix's super lavish new series, The Crown, and then also the new sci-fi movie Arrival, which premiered at the Toronto Film Festival and opens this weekend. First, a few bits of news in the Oscar race. We keep talking about Fences, which is directed by Denzel Washington, August Wilson adaptation, and seems like an Oscar slam dunk for Viola Davis. And there are no reviews out of Fences, but it's screened for an industry audience, quote unquote, in Los Angeles. And there are various posts online kind of talking about how there's buzz emerging that basically confirms what we all thought, which is that Denzel Washington and Viola Davis are really in the Oscar race. Mike, what's the point of screenings like this when people are kind of like, nah, I saw the movie, I can't talk about it, but clear space on Viola Davis's mantle. Like, is it just to keep the hype machine going?
Yeah, it's literally this moment right now.
We are feeding into the machine.
They hand select a group of people and they're kind of creating their own outcome in two ways, or tipping the scale in two ways. One is they're pre-selecting who they're going to invite.
Definitely.
Knowing that these are people who are like friendly to movies, who like everything, whatever it is. I don't want to cast aspersions, but that's what they're trying to do.
Well, also,
put it that way, whether or not they're successfully doing it or not.
And like, we're also sitting here jealous because none of us got to go.
Yes, of course. Okay. keep that in mind. And secondly, by flattering them. And I've been to plenty of these things. Believe me, it's fine. I'm cool with everybody involved in this. But just to elucidate what's happening, then by flattering them, by saying you're the only people who've seen this and you're not even allowed to say that you saw this, they make them even more inclined to like the movie because everyone wants to be the first to see a movie that's really good, not like a movie that sucks. And then it's very kind of like wink, wink, nod, nod, please don't say anything.
Yeah.
And knowing that these people are going to do everything in their power to kind of let it be known that they saw it and that it's amazing.
Yeah. And you have Denzel Washington in the room to do a Q&A after. So even if you're kind of cool on it, you're like, oh, wow, hey, Denzel Washington's really charming. And this happens not just at wink, wink, nudge, nudge screenings, but many, many Q&As throughout the season where you warm up to the star at the end of it.
And frequently they'll stock the audience with friendly people as well who aren't journalists, right? So they're also bringing in some group of people who are so unbelievably flattered they're there that they're like giving a standing ovation at the end of it.
Yeah.
That's how I saw Selma. Great way to see a movie. I really was very pro Selma by the end of that. Ava DuVernay hanging out with us. You guys are the very first people to see this movie. How could you not love that movie? It's a good movie.
Yeah.
But like, you know, it works.
I think I was at that screening. I literally texted someone like, I've seen the Best Picture winner.
Right.
Didn't work out. Don't listen to my Oscar predictions. Yeah. I mean, Joanna, you were at the Mill Valley Film Festival, which is another version of this. You know, there's definitely some Oscar voters up in the Marin County. I mean, is the vibe in that room so much that you think it can just really like create buzz that doesn't exist? Or should we believe that, you know, Washington and Davis have it all in the bag?
Oh, no, I think I remember you coming out of that Selma screening.
Like, were you the person I texted?
I think so. I think it is that film festival mood that we talk about to the extreme of just sort of, you got this starstruck tunnel vision that even the best of us are susceptible to. I certainly was when Emma Stone was at the La La Land screening. Like, you know, you just feel it. I think it's impossible to take any of that with a clear eye. But, and that being said, you know, I've read the coverage of it and it's so vague and wink, wink that I just don't know what opinions we can form out of that fence of screening at all.
Here's what I'm reading at Variety, written by Chris Tapley, who's been writing about award season for a long time and is, you know, knows as much about this as anyone. He said, reviews are currently embargoed, but it's fair to at least note that both Washington and Davis have now charged ahead in their respective Oscar races. The crowd certainly seemed to agree with that sentiment, bursting into applause after multiple big moments in the film and greeting the whole team with an enthusiastic standing ovation afterwards.
Got that standing ovation.
I mean,
you don't,
so did
don't do, if you're not going to get the standing ovation, don't bother doing it. You know, I mean, this thing is designed for a standing ovation.
Yeah. Real quick, what you said about Emma Stone. Emma Stone has been everywhere lately. Like, she is showing up at Q&As and film festivals with La La Land and to a degree that, like, I'm really impressed by. Like, she's a big A-list star and doesn't have to do this.
You think she wants an Oscar? You think she thinks she can smell it? Especially now that Viola left?
Well, I think I told you my theory, and I feel like we keep coming back to Best Actress by accident, but okay. My theory is that Emma and Natalie Portman split the younger vote in Annette Bening, Storms In and Wins. But
It could happen. I don't know. I mean, I'm very bullish on Emma. But to come back to Fences, I did hear from a veteran Oscar watcher who was not part of that little screening, a very succinct, somewhat dismissive thing, which was Fences is a play.
Ooh.
That was it. That's all they said. But that was in the context of Best Picture.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anyone coming out of this is saying it's going to win Best Picture, right?
It's hard to know.
I mean, I think what people are saying is basically it's correct that what everyone thought, which is that Viola Davis is a shoo-in for a supporting actress, is basically true.
Mm-hmm.
And something that we had discussed in the dark as we remain,
yeah,
that Denzel was probably going to get into Best Actor. Mm-hmm. And one of the people coming out was like, it's going to be real interesting between Denzel and Casey Affleck.
Oscars already. That would be really impressive. If he went for a third for this.
Now, of course, I wonder, the fact that he directed it probably does help him in a way. Mm-hmm. Like, it makes it this accomplishment times two.
Yeah.
On the other hand, he has won a bunch of stuff before. And the fact that one of the people at that screening designed to make you think that this is the greatest movie in history was still saying that Denzel was going to have to grapple with Casey Affleck makes me think Casey Affleck might still actually be in the lead position.
Yeah.
But we are obviously grasping at straws here.
Yeah. Hopefully someone will invite us
Since
to a
no one invited us to the damn screening.
I know. Well, all the buzz is in Los Angeles this week because it's also the AFI Film Festival. It's going to have the premiere of Peter Berg's Boston Marathon. Marathon movie Patriots Day, but that's next week. This week it's opening with Warren Beatty's Rules Don't Apply, the Howard Hughes movie. And there's also a sense that Paramount has premiered some of their big contenders there as surprise screenings. In the past, last year they brought The Big Short there, and believe it or not, The Big Short's Oscar buzz didn't start until mid-November, which feels crazy.
12 years ago it feels like. 12 months ago no one even had heard of The Big Short.
So they've got both Silence and Fences, as we were just discussing, so there's still room for that to happen. But in the meantime, we're going to have both Warren Beatty and Annette Bening on hand for Rules Don't Apply in 20th Century Women. So that power couple's back in. That's going to be fun.
That's pretty cool. I'm into that. What else is opening? I have no idea.
Well, La La Land is there. Jackie's there. Okay. It's a lot of the kind of familiar titles you've been seeing. And then there's a movie with Robert De Niro called The Comedian that could be really interesting or could be nothing, and it's kind of hard to tell. So we'll have reports on that next week when some of our LA colleagues have seen it.
Am I right that La La Land is kind of in the lead position for Best Picture or not really?
I mean, I don't, unless Silence is kind of waiting in the wings as a huge thing, which, I mean, and it's unseen, so you can't really say that. I can't think of anything that's ahead of La La Land in terms of goodwill.
I've heard that Hidden Figures is a threat. I mean, I don't know if this is...
I don't
know
if anyone's seen it.
Yeah.
But they will soon.
I'm not getting Best Picture winner off of the Rules Don't Apply buzz. But.
Yeah. Yeah. I think everyone's glad to have Warren Beatty back, mm-hmm. but it seems like if it were a real threat waiting in the wings, we'd know about it by now.
Yeah. I don't know. Joanna, are you hearing anything?
From out here on the coast, I think the same rules do apply to this that we talked about earlier, which is that there's this mood that we want an uplifting film in the front of the Best Picture race this year more than any other year. So La La Land, I still hear a lot of good things
now
about that.
Assuming that Hillary wins, does that change? Do
I'm
people
knocking on the table
I
mean, right now?
You know, I feel quite confident it's noon on election day. I feel personally confident, knock on wood, that Hillary's going to win. Is that going to change? Like, are people then going to be like, hey, we're great. Let's like give it to Moonlight.
Oh God, I don't know. It's you know, the movie industry is such a slow moving thing. You to turn that cruise ship takes a long time.
Right.
It's hard to know if how the national mood might affect.
Because I have heard that the response to La La Land is divided. That some people love it and some people not so much.
But it isn't like a hopeful, happy movie. You know.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, Slumdog Millionaire won the year that Obama won, and that's a movie about, you know, an underdog coming up from nothing. And, you know, I think people like at the time, like literally like it's the Obama of movies, which was crazy. But it
worked. So is La La Land about a female scrappy striver, the Hillary Clinton movie?
Or it's a love letter to the establishment, the Hollywood establishment instead of the political establishment. You can really take this a lot of ways.
It's the Hillary of movies.
God.
Yeah, I would like to see that on the poster. Mike Hogan, Hillary of movies.
Luckily, Richard Lawson is already quoted on the posters, so he's representing us well.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Well, this is a nice segue into politics and movies with The Crown, which is about, I guess it's kind of another form of escapism because it's about political figures who are in the past and also not in this country. Joanna, have you watched all of The Crown?
I have.
Oh,
I
my
did.
God.
Yes.
Man, it's 10 episodes. It debuted on Netflix last Friday.
10 hours that I devoured of British political intrigue. It's so good.
I'm really excited to watch it.
It's so good.
Is it like if you love Downton Abbey, you'll love this kind of thing? Or do you feel like it has an even broader appeal?
God, I think it's so much better than Downton Abbey. You know, Vanity Fair obviously has a long love affair with the British royalty. I am not one of those people who has ever had like stars in their eyes for the British royalty. So like this was not necessarily going to be a hit with me. But I think Peter Morgan, who also did the film The Queen with Helen Mirren and The Audience, also with Helen Mirren, right, the play, has spent a long time studying Queen Elizabeth. And so to see this figure at the very start of her career, to see a play beautifully by Claire Foy, to see it mirrored with Winston Churchill at the end of his career, played by John Lithgow, to meet all these other figures that were emerging in British politics in the 1950s, other prime ministers, other cabinet members, private secretaries in the palace, all of this, it's just enthralling to me. And, you know, Peter Morgan's a very classy writer. He, for the most part, avoids the most salacious take that, you know, I was sort of comparing this to The People versus O.J. Simpson, which was smart. It was smart. It was really compelling, but it was also kind of trashy at times. And I feel like this take is the smart and the compelling without feeling the need to go the I like the trashy of People versus O.J., of course, but like without even having to dip into that. You have the love affair of Princess Margaret, but the only reason that that is a centerpiece in season one is because it's just a huge, huge thing that Elizabeth had to grapple with right at the start of her rule. And the other thing I want to say is that Jared Harris shows up as King George, I don't know, the fourth? Elizabeth's father. I don't know the number. Yeah, Elizabeth's father, the dying king, and he is incredible. And I say that as someone who thought he was just incredible on Mad Men as Lane Price, but this is the performance of Jared Harris's career this monarch who is just like, he's in a significant part of the first two episodes, and then spoiler alert, flashbacks for the rest of the season because he dies. But
this is the sequel to the King's Speech.
Yeah, well, this is Colin Firth, right? That's that George, the stuttering King George.
Exactly, okay. The stuttering King George, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So he barely stutters, but you see it. And it, you know, and you see his relationship with his brother, who was, that was also part of the King's Speech and all of that.
How about his speech therapist? Do we get him in there?
I don't. No, Jeffrey Rush, not a single peep.
That's fine. But I think if Lee Daniels had produced, that would have made, that would have found its way in.
Yes, definitely. So anyway, I thought it was amazing. I am a sucker for costume drama, and I'm also a sucker for, you know, a deep bench of British actors. So you have, you know, Jeremy Northam and Greg Wise and all, just all these like really, really fine actors that they got. The production value is insane. We know that Netflix spent millions and millions of dollars on this, and it shows in the best way. And I'm just a huge fan. I think it's the best thing Netflix has done all year for me, for my taste.
Whoa. So. Better than Stranger Things.
But, oh, wait. Yeah. For me, way better than Stranger Things. You know, okay. Netflix has their little algorithms, right?
Yeah.
Whatever this show is, it's like the Joanna algorithm. You know, they're like, oh, we've got people who like British things and costumes and women being strong and tested. And right. Yeah, it's the Joanna Robbins. It's the Joanna Robinson of shows.
So, I just watched Narcos. I just completely binged, inhaled, you might say, snorted two seasons of Narcos. But this is better than Narcos. Did you like Narcos?
I only saw the first season of Narcos, to be fair. And I do like this better than Narcos. But I think Narcos is a little underrated.
Yeah.
Do you agree, Mike? Like that? I mean, you inhaled two seasons, but I think it doesn't get quite the respect it deserves.
Yeah. I know. I mean, I thought it was like phenomenally great, but I might have just gotten caught up in it. But also, it's funny what you say about the trashiness, because actually that's one of the things that I liked about Downton Abbey was the sort of silliness of it. But I think that didn't really come into play until later seasons. The first one was really sort of just a perfect little drama. And then it was after a while where you could see Julian Fellowes or whatever just being like, oh, what the hell else am I going to do with these people? I got to do a car crash. I got to have a secret kid.
Well, and with the royals, you know all this crazy stuff that's coming.
Right. Like, it's like,
you know,
it's
season
real.
Four, Diana shows up and it's going to be a whole different fascinating show.
Yeah.
Well, and that's, you know, that's the thing. They plan to do, what is it, six seasons?
I don't know. Sounds about right.
You know, Queen Elizabeth's entire reign. So, of course, the Diana stuff is coming. And what's fascinating then is to watch this season, watch her grapple with Princess Margaret's affair and the notion of divorce and the church and what's allowed royals and what isn't. And knowing that that is just going to come right back around with Diana and Charles is really interesting.
Here's something no actress should want to do. Play Diana. It's like trying to play OJ for Cuba. He just cannot match
Naomi
it.
Watts tried it with that movie that did get released eventually. She had a Diana movie that just kind of fell apart. I mean, it was made, but no one ever saw it. So who
knows? Good luck.
There are also just a few actors that popped up in this season with very small parts that I was surprised they didn't save them for later seasons of The Queen. Like, you know, Stephen Delane, who plays Stannis on Game of Thrones, shows up to play this modernist painter in a great episode and a half appearance. But that's it. Like, that painter's not coming back. And I was like, really? You used Stephen Delane for that? You didn't want to save him for, I don't know, whatever figure we have coming? And there's also just, you know, I feel like I consider myself relatively familiar with the royals, not an obsessive, but relatively familiar. And there's still just a lot of information in this that I wound up, you know, looking up on Wikipedia. That's one of the joys of watching a real life thing unfold is Googling, wait, what actually happened? Wait, this did actually happen? Oh my God. So yeah, it's really lovely. And, you know, Peter Morgan just has like a really refined touch. I agree with you, Mike, that Downton Abbey season one was spectacular. I really loved that first season, and I would compare it to that, to the first season of Downton.
So looking at the Emmy side of things, you know, for our awards connection, it's interesting because Netflix has had, you know, some really high-profile success at the Emmys. Like, it's had a lot of actors win. Uzo Aduba is kind of a perennial favorite. Matt Mendelsohn won this year, but they've never won a series award, even though House of Cards was such a big deal when it debuted. And it really seems like this kind of lavish, beautiful, expensive thing is a way for them to be like, hello, yes, you have to pay attention to us. You know, if they still feel like the new kids in town, this might be a good way to fix that.
Yeah, I just don't know. I don't know that it's going to get there. I'm really curious to see how much people wind up talking about this show actually, because I know season two is already filming, so like they're going to do a season two, but it's so expensive. We know Netflix has deep pockets, but I'm not seeing a lot of buzz around it other than like nerdy British costume drama loving people like myself. So I don't know if it has like the breakout appeal of Stranger Things to become a wider interest thing. Then again, Bloodline wasn't, and Ben Mendelsohn won an award. I could see like Jared Harris getting an acting award. I really could. And I certainly believe that Claire Foy, who plays Queen Elizabeth, should be nominated because she is exquisite.
The Jared Harris thing would fit pretty nicely into a standard Emmy move, which is to take somebody for the next thing after. It's kind of like the Julie Louis-Dreyfus, you know, you're going to get Emmys until you die because we all love Seinfeld, and Veep's pretty good too.
Yeah.
Right. We miss Mad Men, so here you go, Jared. Yeah.
Well, and given how well Downton Abbey did with the Emmys for so long, like those royals loving people like you probably make up a lot of Emmy votes.
Yeah, no, I would expect that this is going to get a lot of, and in terms of costuming and set design, like it has a shot at a lot of technical awards. The costuming is no surprise by Michelle Clapton, who does Game of Thrones. So when I saw her name on the credits, I was like, of course it's Michelle Clapton. It's incredible. It's just really
incredible. Is that what she left Game of Thrones for?
Yeah, I believe so.
Man.
She briefly left Game of Thrones to launch another show about political intrigue. And you know, and there are moments like in the finale, like I said, it's not over the top. Like I think this series is really restrained, but there is a moment in the finale when, you know, you sort of see all the threads come together and sort of previewing the threat of future seasons with like what we know Elizabeth had to grapple with during her reign. And it's a little montage-y and it's a little Thronesy. Like it's a little like at the end of the Game of Thrones, when you see all the individual storylines headed towards their thing they're going to do next season, you know? So I'm sure that Netflix wanted a little bit of that Thrones, Queen Cersei, Queen Elizabeth vibe from it.
Well, I do think awards for a project like this, if we're concerned that it's not going to have and really never could have the kind of online buzz of like a Game of Thrones type of a show or a Walking Dead type of a show, if it does kind of come in and get a bunch of Emmy love, that's going to give them a lot more reason to keep going than if it's just like, oh, a lot of Netflix subscribers like this and people admire it, but we're not seeing like a distinct payoff from this $100 million budget or whatever it is.
Yeah, although they've got all the money in the world, so keep spending it.
Then there's that.
Yeah. Well, Mike, now it's your time to tell us all about something that we may or may not love.
Okay.
Joanna and I have not seen Arrival, but you have. It's kind of a big release this weekend coming on the heels of Doctor Strange, another version of outer space. I don't know. I didn't see Doctor Strange, so I don't know how much. I don't know how much outer space.
And then
space
we get Passengers. Then we get Passengers coming.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Well,
it's a lot of space stuff going on.
So, Arrival played at Toronto, and people really seem to be falling in love with it. It's from Denis Villeneuve, who made Sicario last year. He made Prisoners before that. His movies tend to attach a really fervent fan base, but this one seems to be hitting even more people. So what's Arrival all about?
Yeah, and I know that you don't tend to like his movies.
Not usually. I really didn't like Prisoners, and it's kind of, I've been kind of working my way out of that. I mean, I like
Sicario
better.
That's an abusive film, but it's, I liked it. I liked it quite a bit. And Sicario, I thought was amazing.
I liked
and just the
parts
sound.
Of Sicario. Yeah. No,
you know, the sound of this guy's movies is, and I'm like a music fanatic, and so it almost starts with the sound. Like, you just know you're in good hands. The way that he sets the sound design, it's all that. I mean, it's not that complicated. It's sort of a twist on the Christopher Nolan, but there's a lot of just like, wah. It's not a Bram. It's kind of like these really grinding soundtracks. It's Bram-ish. It's Bram-ish.
Yeah.
But Amy Adams is really good, and it's just an incredibly haunting thing. You know, like all these movies, it's pulling in stuff from Close Encounters and from, you know, District 9. Basically, these giant ships arrive on Earth in a bunch of different countries, and everybody's trying to figure out what the hell it means and what do they want. And so Amy Adams comes in and is enlisted because she's a scientist, and she and Jeremy Renner are sort of working together. The military brings them in. Forrest Whitaker is great as this colonel who's sort of trying to, like, figure out what the hell is going on before the lunatic hotheads in the military take over.
Forest Whitaker in this and Rogue One. He's just rocking outer space.
Yeah. So they don't, you know, they don't have a lot of time to kind of get to the bottom of what these aliens want. Is this a threat? Is this a, you know, an overture? It's certainly really spooky. And so there's just this weird feeling of kind of dread hanging over the whole thing, which is that's Villeneuve's mood, right? He does dread really well.
Yeah, and like variations on dread, you know, Sicario has a different kind than Prisoners.
What I like about Sicario and this one is that in both cases, it's this really tough woman at the center of it, basically using her wits to kind of like try and get through what's seemingly an impossible situation.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's gorgeously shot, really nice performances. Jeremy Renner is more likable here than he has been maybe ever. I mean, he kind of made his, look, but with all due respect, like he made his career playing sort of, you know, jerks. So, so it was cool. It's cool to see him in a supporting role where he's like, pretty cool guy. He's like ostensibly a jerk, but you know with the heart of gold type of deal.
Yeah.
And then there is this twist, you know, which I don't want to say anything about, but it ends in a kind of a Nolan-y place where you're like, whoa, okay, everything I saw has a new light on.
Yeah, I keep hearing people talking about the twist, and it's kind of nice because no one has really come close to spoiling it for me. But I'm aware that there's.
It's almost like too weird to. Spoil. Do you know what I mean?
I mean,
I would have a little bit of a hard time explaining exactly, but I also saw it about a month and a half ago.
Yeah.
At one of these screenings where I felt very lucky to be there. So take everything I say with a giant grain of salt. I also met Amy and Jeremy there.
Good friends now.
Yeah. We're pals. But no, it's a cool film.
Yeah. I mean, I want to hear about Amy Adams a little bit more because she's going to reach a point where she's going to set a record for Oscar nominations without a win. But it feels like this is really going to help her get there. Like, is it that she's so good at this point that we expect her to be good? And therefore, when she turns in a good performance like this, and it's like, oh, well, you're just being great like Amy Adams is.
I think that might be what it is. Because I think a lot of times when you give someone the award, it's you're like, holy shit, I never imagined that you would do that. And with Amy, you're just like, of course, this is, you're like a perfect in this role.
Well, Meryl Streep went 25 years between her Oscars, which seems crazy because every time she blows people away.
Yeah. And so, I mean, there's something about Amy Adams, I think that is, even though she's definitely 100% a movie star, on the range of thespian to movie star, I think she's still on the thespian side. And those people, you know, they're graded on a different curve. Like if a full-on movie star who makes everybody faint when they walk down the street can actually act, you're sort of like, holy cow, like give this person an award.
Uh-huh.
You know, whereas somebody who came into it, got their stardom by being amazing in a lot of stuff, they frequently will get a supporting for their first sort of like amazing breakout. But once they're
like
past
that. Like Junebug, which Amy Adams did.
Yeah. And then once they're past that, they're sort of like, you know, you're like, yeah, Amy Adams.
Yeah. Because we saw her being great in the very beginning and now it's just kind of her default.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like you guys are all forgetting about Drop Dead Gorgeous, which was Amy Adams' real first film.
She's amazing. No, I mean, Drop Dead Gorgeous is full of so many amazing performances that it's hard for her to stand
it's
out.
True.
But no, it's Drop Dead Gorgeous is a real all-time favorite, and she's great in that.
My question then is, you know, if we're going to have this conversation around Arrival as a Best Actress vehicle and possibly even a Best Picture contender, what does the fact that it's a genre film, like a hard sci-fi film, how does that affect the chances? Or are we past that, past genre prejudice? Like, what do we think?
That's interesting, because even with The Martian last year, we kept talking about genre prejudice. And then, you know, it made it in there. It wasn't like a big contender, but it made it in so safely that it really does now feel like no one's talking about that with Arrival.
Yeah, I think it still makes it a hurdle to win, right? Because basically Villeneuve is like, he's like, I'm trying to think of the author to compare it to, but it's really high class sort of pulp, you know, whether he's doing sci-fi or whatever he's doing. I mean, Sicario is like a Don Winslow novel. And this one is whoever is the best kind of person at high class sci-fi. Something like that, right? Yeah. So, but more modern. So I think there's no question that you can give it a Best Picture nomination, but I think for it to win, it would have to get to another level that it doesn't get to. Because at the end of the day, you're just in hand really enjoying something. It's very Christopher Nolan-y. The same reason why it's hard for Nolan to win.
But if
is
it,
this.
If it became a mega hit like Gravity, like would that be a different conversation? Because remember, people thought Gravity was going to walk away with it all.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure, right? I think. I don't know that it's going to become a mega hit.
Yeah. I mean, Gravity was a whole its own kind of spectacle.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, George Clooney and Sandra Bullock,
and
that's
like
some
the 3D
serious
that blows your mind
freaking star power and, yeah. and the 3D. Gravity was this almost self-contained little... It was almost more awardsy in the way that it was like showing off. Like
we did
something very simple, but we did it so well that no one will ever be able to do it again. Mm-hmm. This is a more conventional, but like Nolan-y sci-fi.
But you keep bringing up space movies as if they're quite the same as like an alien invasion movie. Like Sandra Bullock in space, or even, you know, Matt Damon on Mars, I feel like is a more in the continuation of like Apollo 13, like things that actually could credibly happen versus an alien invasion, which, you know, might spark like Independence Day to people, or, you know, the visions of spaceships in the sky evoke summer entertainment more than it does, you know, Oscar. So, you know, I'm really excited to see Arrival. I love Villeneuve as opposed to Katie, who's a hater. I'm just kidding. But, you know, I'm really excited to see sort of what it does with that, not just genre, but like that cliche, that movie cliche of the alien invasion. And what I've heard from people is that it's a really fresh take on it. So I'm intrigued.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one part Close Encounters meets Inception. But it definitely has a new take on it. There's stuff that you haven't seen before, you know, despite those building blocks. But I will say, you know, Spielberg benefits by having a really big kind of mawkish streak that appeals to Oscar voters. Villeneuve does not.
Yeah.
I mean, this thing is fucking cold.
Mm-hmm.
This is a cold movie.
Like Christopher Nolan.
Yeah.
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 Well, those of us who've been watching Westworld are all bathed in that Nolan chilliness, so maybe the time is right.
I'm just glad I can watch something Joanna loves that isn't Westworld after this conversation.
So we're going to go big before we go home and turn to the best original song category. Joanna, you have a major advantage here because you've seen Moana, where I assume the winner is going to come from, even though I know nothing about the songs in the movie. What do you think?
Honestly, it's a bit of a cheat, I think. You and Richard talked about this on the podcast. I think the Lin-Manuel Miranda momentum might push Moana into a place that maybe it doesn't quite deserve. I think the songs, I've heard better songs from Lin-Manuel Miranda.
A little thing called Hamilton might be better.
Yeah, a little thing called Hamilton. But there's a big sweeping sort of inspirational show-stopping number that Lin actually sings on in the movie, even though he's not a character in the movie. His voice is on the song. I definitely think he will be performing that at the Oscars. Whether or not that gets him the Oscar, I don't know. But I would say that would have my bet right now.
Mike, what do you think?
The only thing I even know or have heard is the stuff from La La Land.
I mean, La La Land is definitely a strong position in this.
Yeah. I mean, I think it'll be interesting because I have a jazz fanatic friend who saw La La Land and was like, who is so similar to Damien Chazelle.
Uh-huh.
I was like, you are Damien Chazelle. Go see the movie. And he came back and he's like, I love the movie. The music is terrible. But I don't think that, but he represents such an extreme like jazz nerd. I mean, I feel like that's actually what Miles Teller's character from Whiplash would have said as well.
Mm-hmm.
Which, so it all just underscores my theory that this friend of mine is Damien Chazelle.
Yeah.
Bottom line is, I think the music's pretty good, you know? I mean, it's not quite Singing in the Rain, but like it's good. And I imagine that if La La Land has the kind of momentum I'm sort of anticipating, that it'll be in there. But man, I mean, Lin-Manuel Miranda,
I know,
is practically God at this point. So how could they not, you know, if they have a chance to give him an Oscar, I think they just will.
Yeah.
I will say, walking out of La La Land, I was like, there isn't one song. Like, most predictors have the audition song, I think, as the breakout from that. And that's
Emma Stone's from the end of the movie.
Emma Stone's performance. You know, and I'm sure it'll be nominated and Emma Stone will sing it at the Oscars. But I don't think it's the best song. And I don't know what the best song is from that movie. Whereas, like, with something like Moana, there's just a clear choice. So, I don't know.
Well, I think you guys are probably right that Lin-Manuel Miranda and whatever the song is from Moana you're talking about, which I'm sure we'll all have stuck in our heads soon enough. But if there's going to be a dark horse, I'm putting my money behind drive it. Like you stole it from mine and yours favorite movie, Joanna, Sing Street. Which, Mike, I don't know if you've seen Sing Street.
No.
It it came out earlier this year. It's from John Carney, who made Once.
Oh, yeah. I love that guy.
It is such a charming movie, and it's got all these original songs that these kids in this band write, but there's one clear standout song called Drive It Like You Stole It that I have stuck in my head now just thinking about it.
Well, I mean, the Once soundtrack is so phenomenally
well,
great.
Well, and Once is a winner in this category.
Yes.
So he has a real...
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I think this movie's probably too small. It's not even, you know, it didn't make the impact that Once did, but...
It can't beat Lin-Manuel. I'm sorry.
No, it's not going to. Right, but if it gets a nomination, I'm going to consider that a victory.
I bet it gets nominated. Yeah.
I just want to see these kids perform at the Oscars and have a bunch of people be like, I want to rent Sing Street on iTunes, which is what I did. And I was totally delighted. So everyone go watch Sing Street and then get that song stuck in your head.
Did you watch them perform at Sundance? Because they did a bunch of onstage performances. The kids did a bunch of onstage performances at Sundance. They actually filmed Sing Street a couple of years ago. So it's a little alarming because they're like handsome young men now. And it's just like, it's not like the Stranger Things kids performing at the Emmys. You're like, whoa, these kids are men. So, yeah.
That does it for this week's Little Gold Men. Thank you so much for listening, and please rate and review us on iTunes. It helps us find new listeners as this award season gets going. You can find us all at vanityfair.com and on Twitter. I'm at Katie Rich. Joanna?
I'm at Joe Rothis.
And Mike, who just had to step away, is at Mike_Hogan. And we're all at Little Gold Men. This episode was edited and produced by Alana Milner, who is celebrating her birthday today. Happy birthday, Alana. And thanks to Laura Mayer and Andy Bowers at Panoply. And this week's award for best description of the mood on election day goes to Mike Hogan.
Is this a threat? Is this a, you know, an overture? It's certainly really spooky.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.